Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. I hope you had a happy 4th of July weekend. It's time for our weekly reporters roundtable. Joining us in the studio is Jim Siegel of the Columbus Dispatch. Welcome to the show, Jim.
Good morning.
And Mark Niket of Bloomberg News. Welcome back, Mark.
Thanks for asking me.
And Karen Kassler, is this your third week in a row?
It doesn't feel like it because every week feels new and
fresh
exciting.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's
so
the spirit.
I think it might be the fourth or third weeks or through what, you know.
Gotcha.
What I mean? Yeah.
Karen Kassler, she's bureau chief for the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau. Jim Siegel, let's start with you. The state finances are in pretty good shape. Apparently with a budget nearly $800 million in the black. That's almost a billion. Where did the savings come from and where do we spend it? Where will we? We as in the state of Ohio.
Oh, don't worry. They didn't leave this money just sitting around. It's most of it's already been accounted for. Basically, you know, we've continued to see an economic upturn. Some would argue it's not been as robust as maybe it should be, but there's been a definite turnaround continuing in revenues, and that has helped. Income tax revenue, I think, was about 2.5% above estimates, and
okay.
So that has definitely helped. So part of it was just tax revenue came in a little stronger than was estimated. But actually, the biggest chunk of that is actually savings from what was not spent, and particularly in Medicaid. Medicaid underspending was pretty large, accounted for a good bit of that $800 million. With the change in the Affordable Care Act, with the expansion of Medicaid, it was difficult to predict, you know, what was exactly going to happen. And at the same time, the economy was turning up, and they weren't sure just how much. So there was some difficulty in projecting Medicaid and exactly what was going to be spent. And as usual, Governor Kasich's budget office often is very conservative with their estimates and also conservative with their spending. If they think that, you know, there could be Medicaid might spend, you know, $8 to $9 billion, they'll take $9 and put it in the budget, and just in case, if they spend less, then great. So that's basically where that came from. Most of that money's already been accounted for. They've created a $300 million Medicaid reserve fund with part of that money. This is essentially in case things happen over the next year that are unexpected, again, because of the Affordable
Care
Act.
Given the expansion, right.
And the expansion, that's there just in case there's some unexpected costs, a little cushion. There's about $400 million of it has gone toward tax cuts that were implemented as part of the off-year budget bill. They added another percentage point onto the income tax cut this year, did a little more business taxes, did a little more for expanding the earned income tax credit, and also personal exemptions were increased, so that impacts some of the lower and middle class folks. So there's still going to be probably less than $200 million that is unaccounted for. That will just roll over into the GRF for the second year of the 2-year budget, and will just be there in case it's
Wait, aren't
needed.
We in the second?
We just started the second.
We
year.
Just started the second. That's right. Okay, and okay. And so does that go into the rainy day fund or?
No, rainy day fund is basically it's full.
It's full.
Okay.
Yeah. I think it's 5% of the GRF is what it's capped at. And it's full. Thanks to large part to the last couple budgets, all of which have ended with surpluses. And so they've been able to build that rainy day fund up. And it's now at about $1.5
billion. Life is good.
Yeah, these ebb and flow. You, as Mark can attest to, he's been around, and Karen have been around. You know, you see these things. It's a roller coaster on these budgets. You know, you go through these years where you've, you know, surplus years, and then you all of a sudden you crater out, and you end up with these years where you're struggling to pay the bills and trying to find ways to not end up with a deficit, which is actually illegal in Ohio.
But they enacted the tax cut, and they didn't necessarily know there was going to be this revenue available, did they?
Yeah, they did. Because they come out with monthly financial reports.
Okay,
the state budget office does, and LSC, the Legislative Service Commission, does as well. So they didn't know exactly how much was going to be available, but there was an idea that there would definitely be enough for the tax cut and in this Medicaid reserve fund. So they were able to pass that ahead of time and make sure it was in place. And if it didn't. There were some triggers built in that if for some reason something really weird happened in the last month and that they didn't have the money, some of these things would have not, you know, been fully funded. But but it was that wasn't the case. So.
And as Jim says, they, you know, the overriding approach of this administration and Budget Director Tim Kaine in particular is to be conservative with mm-hmm. both spending estimates and revenue estimates. And, you know, you could follow month by month how they're tracking, you know, estimates versus actual collections, so they knew where they were. But they touted that this is the fourth year that they've had a surplus at the end of a budget year. And, you know, it has allowed them to bring the rainy day fund from 89 cents after the recession to the $1.5 billion cap. And there's something to be said for that because it does give you, you know, flexibility with your budget. And, you know, now we have $200 million, you know, rolling into the next budget if in case there's something unexpected, whatnot. And obviously the big fight's going to be about, well, what was the best use of the additional funds we had? You know, the bulk of it went to tax cuts, which, you know, the Democrats will say is just, you know, essentially more help for the rich, essentially that the most of the benefit goes to the higher income folks, and the money could have been better spent either with a different type of tax cut or, you know, using some of that money to help local governments who
restore
saw their
cuts
funding
that from local
cut,
governments
right, or schools yep. or some other priority for spending.
Yeah, and and just real quick, an analysis of the tax plan did show that about 50% of the money saved from these latest tax cuts go to the top 5% of income earners.
And what Mark just said about the cuts to local governments and schools, that's where Democrats want to see that money go. That's mm-hmm. probably the one place we could say it won't go, because Governor Kasich has been very clear from the beginning that he wanted to reduce the amount of money going out of the local government fund to local governments, and the administration does believe that they are increasing funding to schools, though there's still a dispute over the amount of money that went to schools versus how much went to schools because of the stimulus money several years ago, mm-hmm. and that these numbers simply aren't the same. But, you know, I talked to Tim Kaine, the budget director, mm-hmm. last week when these numbers came out. Normally, he's really very, I almost want to say practiced. He's very measured in his responses. He's very clear. He was in the best mood. I mean, he was just like, hey, how are you? You know, and you can, I mean, when like Mark said, this is the fourth quarter in a row where this is, or the fourth year in a row, you can see why somebody would be in a good mood. In an election year for these kind of numbers, you know, you can see why somebody would be a little bit more casual and feeling like the pressure might be temporarily off right now.
It was a very happy fiscal New Year's Eve. Do they still do that party? Yeah. They have a party to celebrate, you know, on June 30th, which is the last day of the fiscal year, and the next day obviously is the start of the new fiscal year. They actually have a party like it's New Year's Eve.
Well, I remember the days when the budget negotiations, of course this was the mid-budget, this was, but they would go right up to the, you know, right up to midnight or beyond, and they'd extend
yeah.
the budget.
It wasn't that long ago that we had budget extensions. I mean, yeah. under Strickland, the budget went...
The recession, the kickoff of the recession.
Yes, the budget went, what was it, 3 weeks it was extended maybe? He kept signing these temporary budget yeah. extensions. So it wasn't... But that it was a two-year budget. This is, you know, the mid-biennium, the halfway through the year. But it wasn't that long ago that we had real controversy over the budget and real situations where it didn't get signed on time.
It sounds like this mid-biennium approach that Governor Kasich has taken with the budget, in other words, making them year budgets instead of two-year budgets, basically, and not having budget correction bills, but complete budget rewrite bills in some cases, seems like it's working for him.
When he said he wants to do it again,
yeah,
when he signed the appropriations,
if he's re-elected,
right? When he signed the appropriations part of the budget, which he actually had two ceremonial budget signings for that one. He did it at the food bank, the Mid Ohio Food Bank down in Grove City, and then he also did it up in Cleveland at a public school. He had said when he was at the Mid Ohio Food Bank that he really does intend to do these things, continue to do them if he is indeed reelected, because he really likes. I guess he likes the idea of being able to talk about the budget items and rolling this whole thing out every year instead of every other year.
The process obviously has its detractors, though, from the idea that, you know, you cram a whole bunch of policy stuff into these MBRs that probably should be handled separately or as part of, you know, separate pieces of legislation, but sort of becomes like a Christmas tree where, you know, in addition to, you know, changing you know, policy things related to the budget, you know, a whole bunch of other stuff ends up in there as well.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, Jim, wasn't there some criticism of the process this year, at least some folks openly questioning whether they should be packing as much in the MVR as they
are? Yeah, it happened on the floor even. Yeah. I can recall...
Republicans or Democrats?
I can recall a Republican, Terry Booth, at least, from Norwalk, was saying that he felt like he didn't get an opportunity to really look over some of these things because there were so many things put in and there was a deadline to get some of the stuff passed. And of course, not all the things that were in Governor Kasich's original MBR proposal got through. I mean, the whole idea of increasing taxes on cigarettes, that's gone nowhere. His severance tax has gone nowhere. The House has passed the severance tax proposal, but he says it's far off from what he wants. And the increase in the commercial activity tax has gone nowhere. So there are still some other items out there that were originally proposed by Governor Kasich that have gone absolutely nowhere in terms of hearings and legislation.
Okay, well, this is about as good a time as any to take a break. If you have any questions or comments for our panel, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Morning.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. It's our weekly reporters roundtable today. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. With me in the studio, Jim Siegel of the Columbus Dispatch, Mark Niquette of Bloomberg News, and Karen Kassler of the Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau. Let's turn to the gubernatorial campaign the gubernatorial race between incumbent Republican John Kasich and Democratic challenger Ed Fitzgerald. Ed Fitzgerald rolled out an energy proposal last week that is at odds with his opponent's stand, but it's also at odds with many of his fellow Democrats in the Ohio General Assembly, not to mention the president of the United States. Mark Niquette, Ed Fitzgerald is opposed to the fracking tax that the governor has worked to increase, as little as he has. He's also critical of the president's new carbon emissions policy, and he would reverse course with Senate Bill 310, which started a two-year freeze on annual increases in state standards for renewable energy and energy efficiency. So what's his overall tack here?
Well, I think most of what's driving it is a response to, as you mentioned, Senate Bill 310, which was the bill that Governor Kasich signed and the legislature obviously passed that, you know, puts a freeze on the energy standards that were enacted under the Strickland administration. And the, you know, debate all along has been, you know, should we keep those standards? Are they the right standards? And the Governor Kasich's view is, you know, we need to take a time out, a pause to study the standards and decide whether, you know, the mandates that are in place are the right amounts at the right levels. And, you know, after 2 years, we're going to have, you know, supposedly some other legislation that will change those standards or, you know, put something else into effect. Otherwise, if nothing happens, we go back to the old standards. But the argument on the part of the folks opposed to this is it's going to have a stifling effect on alternative energy development in Ohio that, you know, absent some kind of a certainty of generation from alternative sources, it's going to be hard for companies to invest in wind power or other types of sources. And Ed Fitzgerald, I think, is seizing mostly on that kind of opposition. Also with the idea that Governor Kasich's the first governor to sign legislation that rolls back these standards to this effect. There have been about 29 states that considered legislation to do kind of what Ohio's doing, but they didn't get enacted. Indiana did change and repeal voluntary standards dealing with energy efficiency, but this is the most sweeping change. So I think he's kind of trying to seize on that. Okay, here's the only, you know, the first governor in America to dramatically roll back these standards, and he's coming out with an alternative. And some of the, you know, positions are a little unclear in terms of exactly how he would accomplish what he wants, you know, in terms of encouraging alternative energy. Mm-hmm. But as you mentioned, he had some interesting pieces of this that sort of run counter to, you know, certainly what the Obama administration had talked about, and had some interesting ideas about how to target development, for example, to areas that are affected by coal changes. You know, if we see reduction in coal jobs, which is a big issue, obviously, in Appalachian Ohio, other parts of Ohio, you know, if we see coal jobs in particular affected by, you know, increases in energy efficiency or, you know, these new standards that are coming out in terms of gas emissions, you know, we should sort of compensate for that. And he also, one of the most tangible pieces of what he talked about was repealing the legislation. This is separate from Senate Bill 310 that changed the limit to how close you could site wind turbines. The complaint, again, is that this is going to discourage the ability to, you know, start new turbine wind projects, particularly in Western Ohio. And Fitzgerald said he would repeal that. So, I mean, what's unclear is just how big a role this will play in the election in terms of how much the voting public cares about this, or at least connects it to the candidates and either would reward Fitzgerald for taking an alternative view or reward, you know, Kasich for what he did. Because part of the problem with the argument all along was, well, who's right? You had both sides sort of making competing claims about, you know, the benefits or the evils of these standards, and I think the public might have a hard time figuring out, okay, who do I blame or credit when it comes time to vote.
There was a float at Duda parade where they mentioned this, and someone did say to me, what's House Bill 310? And it's like, okay, so not a hot topic, apparently.
Well, I think
it is among certain people.
And it's tough because there are so many bills. I mean, 310, that implies there's been a lot of
at
bills
least
before
309,
that. And,
right.
And of course, obviously, not all of them even get a hearing, much less pass. But I think a lot of folks don't know the number of a bill necessarily. I mean, Senate Bill 5 was kind of an outlier there, and they really made that a big deal in terms of the number. But when you start talking about bill numbers, a lot of people just really tune out because it's too hard to keep up with what in the world that one is. But 310 did get, I mean, there were ads that were airing on TV from a coalition that was opposed to Senate Bill 310. And so at least it did get out there in some ways. And certainly people in the environmental community and manufacturers and other groups were very, very concerned about it. So I'm not surprised at all that it showed up in Duda.
Do you think Ed Fitzgerald's onto something, or do you think he's missing the boat focusing on something like this, Jim Siegel?
Well, I think he needs to keep the focus. If he wants to make this an issue, he needs to keep the focus on the jobs aspect of it, which is on bringing in renewable energy jobs, clean energy jobs, getting Ohio either up front or at least among those who are developing this new industry. And that I think is that, and that's been the concern I've heard mostly from an economic standpoint. Both sides are making arguments about, you know, utility bills and costs, and both sides are it's hard to keep track of, you know, cause some both of them make good points, but at the same time they wash each other out at some points too. So this, I think, you know, if he wants to say, look, because, you know, there's stuff in there like, you know, that they've in 310, like, we no longer have to purchase our renewable power from inside Ohio, and that's been a major concern among those who oppose the bill, saying that that's going to mean that Ohio is no longer going to be a place or where these companies are going to come and try to create, you know, build solar panels and put up wind turbines and try to do other types of alternative fuels. And so that, I think that's probably, that would resonate more, I would guess, with than just an argument about standards and those types of things.
Has anyone posed the issue of job losses in the renewables to, say, Governor Kasich or the Republicans who supported this?
I think both sides have their job losses numbers, and both sides have their economic impact numbers. And so you're dealing with dueling numbers and studies and statistics here in many cases, as we are in a lot of different situations and a lot of different bills. But when I asked Governor Kasich about this, he did not want to call this a freeze, which is what we have been calling it. It's a 2-year freeze. Mm-hmm. He says it's a pause, implying that there will be a time when it steps back up again, and that the governor really felt that this was a moderate solution because Senator Bill Seitz's bill would have gotten rid of the standards entirely, mm-hmm. and this was kind of a halfway point between keeping the standards as they are and getting rid of the standards. And so there's a feeling among those who supported 310, I think, that if the standards aren't working, we need an opportunity to look at that, and that this is a moderate proposal, and then we can make some changes later. But I think the people who supported Senate Bill 310, and a lot of those people, that's Ed Fitzgerald's base. I mean, a lot of Democrat supporters, Democratic Party supporters in the party with regard to environmentalists and unions and some of these other groups were very strongly supportive of the standards. And so obviously Ed Fitzgerald has to be concerned about this. Those folks feel that this pause, freeze, whatever you want to call it, is the first step toward getting rid of these standards entirely. And they're very worried about that.
What's interesting, though, is those same folks are not going to be happy at all that Ed Fitzgerald has come out and said, I oppose any increase in the severance tax. This is on the tax that would be levied against basically against fracking, the horizontal shale drilling. Governor Kasich has asked for certain amounts. The legislature has been resistant. The House did pass a bill that Kasich said doesn't go nearly far enough. It includes a lot of exemptions, and at a certain point, depending on what your estimates are on the amount of drilling that will happen, it could produce very little. It could produce some, or it could produce almost nothing, depending on where you go. So the fact that he came out and basically said, I don't think we should increase the severance tax, that puts him way out of step with Democrats across the spectrum. I don't know that I've heard any Democrat outside of maybe a handful in a few of the eastern Ohio counties where this is big that say we shouldn't do it at all. And even they tend to argue we should do it, but we should make sure the revenue comes back to us in this area. So just to say no really puts him out of step. And I don't know how he's going to, you know, reconcile that with a lot of folks who are with him on other parts of his energy policy.
Yeah, the argument there is that somehow this tax will discourage development, that we're going to, you know, kill the golden goose, as it were, by making it too expensive to drill here. And the other side of that is, you know, the gas is here, the oil is here. You want it, you come get it. And, you know, the severance tax in place is not out of step with other states. In fact, even what Governor Kasich had proposed increasing it to would not put us, you know, way out of bounds when it comes to neighboring states or other states that have severance tax. And, you know, the argument there is we need to have some kind of compensation for the minerals, the, you know, natural resources we're pulling out from the ground. And Jim's right. I mean, even the Democrats who, you know, aren't wild about the severance tax, their complaint is mostly, you know, particularly in eastern Ohio, their roads are getting hammered by the rigs dealing with drilling. You know, their infrastructure is being taxed. They need to be compensated more for the impact that drilling is having on their communities. And that's where, like, a severance tax could help by, you know, shifting some of those dollars to areas to help them with those needs.
We're going to devote an hour tomorrow to the issue of the oil and gas industry in the state of Ohio. Get an update on production and all of these sorts of issues if you want to listen. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We have an email. Well, let's take a call real quick first. Len in Lewis Center, you're on the air. Hi, Len.
Well, hi, Ann. Thank you very much for taking the call.
You're welcome.
I'm going to pull over to the side of the road here.
Thank you.
I know that Representative Margaret Ruhl had introduced a bill to make smoking illegal, or in fact, tobacco use period illegal in all of the schools in Ohio.
The colleges and that kind of thing?
The high schools and elementary schools, the public school system.
Isn't it already?
And, well, isn't that interesting you should say that, because that's how many people feel, but if you go to a football game with a different school, you don't know if there's going to be smoking in the stadium or not, for instance. And it is a bad thing, because a kid sees one of their teachers they look up to smoking on a loading dock, for instance, because they can't smoke indoors, but they can smoke outdoors. That's just a bad precedent to send.
So you're supportive of the legislation, then, I take it.
Oh, I am. And the committee, that's a Republican-run committee, has heard the bill several months ago, and it's gotten absolutely positively nowhere. The State Board of Education, a couple of years ago, unanimously agreed that there should be no smoking and suggested to all the school systems and school districts that they come up with such a rule, but they can't make a law, and so they can only recommend. So it's just, I just can't see why the legislature could possibly not take action on this bill.
Well, I'm in la-la land, because there's no tobacco use allowed on the whole campus of Ohio State University now. I guess I'm just in a bubble. Len, thanks a lot for the call. We'll talk about that.
Sure, thank you.
All right, take care. Any idea about this? Is it overreach?
Well, and you do have a legislature that's dominated by Republicans who are very concerned about any sort of overreach, I think. Mm-hmm. And there have been bills. I know there's been a bill that's been repeatedly proposed by Senator Charlie Tavares of Columbus about smoking in cars with kids under the age of six. Mm-hmm. And that's typically gone nowhere as well. So I haven't heard about this, and he's got me interested. So I'm like,
yeah,
checking right here on my phone just to see where that bill is. But I think for some lawmakers, it might be easier, you know, they don't want smoking in schools, but it might be easier for them to continue their stance if school districts made those rules instead of if there were a state law.
Hmm.
Yeah, I think there would, although I think the trend is certainly working this way. Like you said, Ohio State has banned it on the entire campus, mm-hmm. and others have done that as well. That, you know, the trend is just working that, you know, against smoking, and it's going to just continue that way. However, I do think that with the legislative makeup, like Karen said, the legislative makeup right now would prefer that be a local decision, probably, and would leave it up to the local schools to ban that if that's what they feel is appropriate.
I have an email from Rita, who writes, why don't reporters ever mention the large outstanding debt that the state owes to the federal government for unemployment insurance? This debt causes businesses to pay a much larger amount for their unemployment insurance because they do not receive the credit for the state's share. If that debt were paid, there would not be such a high surplus. Interesting. Mark Nick had any ideas about that?
No, so the email person who sent that is right. Ohio owes a significant amount. I'm not sure exactly what the total is, but essentially we were borrowing money to keep that fund solvent during the lean years of the recession, and the expectation was you'd pay it back, and it hasn't been paid back, and it is an outstanding debt that the state owes and does need to deal with. The person who emailed is exactly right.
Yeah, my colleague Kathy Kandisky has written a few stories about this over the past year or two, and it's a confounding issue in that, you know, here the state continues to offer up tax cuts to businesses and tax cuts to individuals and do other things. At the same time, this debt lingers, and it directly costs business owners money per employee. I think it
costs more because they're paying, right, what, the interest on it or something, or what?
They're not paying the interest. It's not exactly that. I don't think that's exactly.
Didn't it trigger some sort of an extra tax or something to try to pay this off? Now, Ohio isn't the only state. I mean, we're one of, what, 30-some states?
But we're one of the biggest
in
terms of the amount owed. I think we're second right now, or third, something like that, in terms of amount owed.
But it's absolutely true. It's still out there, and it's still not dealt with, and it still needs to be dealt with.
Big number. I'm not sure exactly how much it is, but it's not like you can just, you know, even tap the rainy day.
Yeah, it was well over $1 billion. I want to say nearly $2 billion.
It was almost two at one point, and I don't know. I mean, we actually have borrowed from it again, even as times have turned better, not as nearly as much, but we've continued to have to occasionally dip into that. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, I think one of the issues is it's not sexy to pay off a federal debt on unemployment. It's much sexier to offer up tax cuts and do other things with that money. So it's
interesting.
You know, it's as with everything with government, it's all about priority, and this has not risen to the priority level yet. And
government/politics,
right? And this whoever wrote this email, I'm sure, you know, the NFIB and the Chamber of Commerce, if they wanted to make a bigger deal out of this, they could very easily hold press conferences, put the pressure on, make them key votes, and we'd probably see more action. But that has not happened, and you'd have to ask those groups why they have not done more, you know, to apply public pressure.
Interesting.
And just for the caller who called about the bill is House Bill 281 that would ban smoking in public schools. And it's had one hearing. It was introduced in October of 2013. It's had one hearing in January, and that is it. So I don't know that it's...
And no one's really heard much about it, so that suggests...
It was news to me.
This is not a top priority, too. Okay, so... Karen Kassler, last week, the NAACP and others asked a federal judge to expand early voting. What are they asking for?
They want that golden week back. They want the week that...
We got the weekend back.
Yeah. Well, and these are, once again, you have all these different rulings and all these different things that are going on with regard to when can Ohioans perform the early voting task in person. There was the ruling a couple weeks ago that restored that final 3 days before the election, which voting rights activists had really wanted. But then this lawsuit by the NAACP and some other folks would try to restore that golden week, which is the week where you can register to vote and vote in the same time. The legislature eliminated that week, and trimming back the early voting window from 35 days to 29, I believe it was. But then when you add the three extra days, there's arguably 32 days to do early voting in Ohio. And so what really is the question for a lot of people is all these different directives and lawsuits and these sorts of things, it puts the question of when can people vote up in the air every single time. We've gone through this since 2005, since we had early voting. There are these revisions and changes all the way down to the last minute. Mm-hmm. And for people who do want to do early voting in person, it's confusing because you don't know exactly necessarily when you can, especially, of course, on that final weekend, which now we do have the court hearings. And Secretary of State John Husted has said that that court ruling, he's going to follow that. Mm-hmm. So that's where you had the Voter Bill of Rights that Representative Alicia Reese from Cincinnati and some other Democrats have proposed that would put it all in the Constitution and nail it down so that it couldn't be changed other than by another constitutional amendment. But that is not going to be on the ballot this year. And I guess we were going to talk about that a little bit later. Maybe I'm jumping the gun a bit.
Right. No. We can bring it up right now. It's among a slew of issues that did not make it to the November ballot. In fact, none of the issues made it on the ballot. That includes same-sex marriage, right to work, medical marijuana, and clean energy. What happened? Just voters aren't in the mood, or were all of these efforts volunteers getting the signatures, or what?
Well, the same-sex marriage amendment, the group that was pushing that—
They had the signatures.
They claim they have the signatures, and they could have put it on the ballot, but they decided to come to an agreement with the other group that was concerned about the timing, not opposed to the idea mm-hmm. of marriage equality, but concerned about the timing. And so they've come to an agreement saying that they are going to wait. So that's where that one ended up, I guess.
And some of these issues just, you know, for lack of a better explanation, didn't have the firepower to get the required signatures. I mm-hmm. mean, it's not an easy bar to clear to get a statewide initiative on the ballot.
In Ohio.
You have to get, I think it's 325,000 signatures. And
a certain number from each county, right?
Exactly. So it's a high bar, and it's there for a reason because, you know, the idea is, you know, we have a legislature in place that enacts laws, and certainly the citizens have a right for direct sort of petition to do these kind of things, but you know, it shouldn't just be any old issue to you know, get on a ballot. You have to show that there's significant support behind your issue to get it on the ballot so that the entire electorate can weigh in on it. So some issues like the Voters' Bill of Rights, I think, just fell short because they didn't have enough signatures. Others, like Karen said, were I think there was sort of agreement that now was not the right time to proceed, or there just really wasn't enough support this year to go forward with it.
The medical marijuana has a huge support if you look at polling on the topic.
But I don't think you have any organized group that's specifically pushing it. I mean, it's one thing to have people who support it, and polls have shown over and over that there is support for it, and if it got on the ballot, it would pass. But you have to have that group or the coalition that goes out there, that has the volunteer force, that gets the 300+ thousand signatures, and that's really hard to do. That takes time, it takes resources, that takes energy and coordination, and a lot of ideas that have a lot of public support don't necessarily have that group that really wants to see it happen. When it comes to the Voter Bill of Rights, mm-hmm. part of the reason they fell short, I think, is they only had about 4 months to make this happen. That's not a lot of time, especially when you consider, I think it was certified in like April. Didn't we still have snow through like June?
That's right.
I mean, you can't really gather signatures.
There were icebergs in Lake Michigan.
I know. And it's hard to gather signatures. This time of year is the prime time, I think, you know, to go door to door, to go to festivals, to go places and gather signatures. Early spring and late winter is just a really terrible time to try to do all that. And when you've got a very short window and, you know, hundreds of thousands of signatures to gather, it's not easy.
Yeah, and just remember that although you need well over 300,000 signatures to make the ballot, that's valid signatures.
Yeah.
Most of these campaigns need to collect at least 600,000 names in order to get to that point, because a lot of them will be invalidated for various reasons. So that's really the hill they're trying to climb.
Yeah, usually if a issue succeeds and gets on the ballot, it's because there's an organization you've paid to go out and circulate petitions and get the signatures needed to qualify.
I'm thinking, like, for specifically the smoking ban.
Yeah.
You know, there's another idea that had a lot of public support, and it wasn't until the American Cancer Society and some of these groups really got together, and it took them a year and a half, I think, to get all the signatures they needed. And so, you know, unless you get a big group like that that has a volunteer force that is committed, or you pay somebody, it's really hard to get those valid signatures to get on the ballot.
What's interesting, too, about the, you mentioned at the top, the legal challenge to election laws is they're starting to get creative. There was a good story in the New York Times yesterday about a challenge to a voting rights law in North Carolina. It actually was a voter ID and had other restrictions on voting, and the complaint is there's voter suppression involved.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the legal argument against these kind of laws has typically been, you know, equal protection kind of case, that some voters, like African-Americans in particular, and poor voters face some discrimination, or the law affects them disproportionately compared with other voters. It makes it more difficult, essentially, for them to vote. And this challenge that's coming up in North Carolina actually involves college students. And it's an argument that the voting law in North Carolina violates the 26th Amendment, which lowered the voting age from 18 to 21 and says that the right to vote should not be denied on the basis of age. So the argument is, you know, these young people are being disproportionately affected by these voting laws. So anyway, just long way of saying the legal challenges are getting more creative to try and block or overturn laws that groups see as either disproportionately affecting certain blocks of voters or for political reasons don't want to see those restrictions in place.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm Ann Fisher. With me in the studio, Kieran Kassler of the Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau, Mark Niket of Bloomberg News, and Jim Siegel of the Columbus Dispatch. It is our weekly reporters roundtable. If you have a question or a comment, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. So there's a situation involving two men vying to become the next Ohio House Speaker. It's led to a criminal investigation that could produce one or more felony charges against a legislative aide. Jim Siegel, can you catch us up on all of this intrigue?
Well, this all surrounds the race for the next House Speaker. Speaker William Batchelder is term limited at the end of this year. And there is, of course, you know, someone has to step up and be the next speaker, which is one of the three most powerful people in state government. And so there's been a long ongoing race among different members to try to, you know, gain enough support to be speaker. Different members have been in, they've been out. Right now, when it came down to it, the two front runners are, and you know, you could probably say there were three, but the two front runners who were Representative Ron Amstutz of Worcester and Representative Cliff Rosenberger of Clarksville down in Southwest Ohio, they got together at the urging of Speaker Batchelder and decided, okay, we'll do our best to get a list of our supporters, and whoever has the longer list, the loser will back the winner. And that's what happened. And so Ron Amstutz is now backing Cliff Rosenberger to be the next speaker. The two of them say that with their two camps combined, they have more than 60% of the caucus behind him. But that doesn't mean it's over. Representative Jim Butler and some who are supporting him say, no, no, no. We believe that, you know, they don't think the numbers are quite as solid as Rosenberger and Amstutz think. So there's going to be an ongoing fight probably all the way through November until after the election, when they'll take the official vote. The caucus and the new members, who, depending on who wins and loses in November, will get together and vote on the leadership team. Now, the story you're referring to is kind of a side issue to all this. Cliff Rosenberger faced a primary this year, and the woman who ran, her name was Barb Cole. So she files, she says she's going to run. And then all of a sudden she gets this letter in the mail from that looks like it came from the office of Jim Butler. Jim Butler, the guy I just mentioned, mm-hmm. who's kind of the outsider trying to hone in on this deal. And it is now Cliff Rosenberger's chief rival for the job of speaker. And so she gets this letter saying, congratulations. I'm so glad, you know, basically very supportive of the fact that she's running against Cliff Rosenberger, offering up, you know, offering up his support and, you know, say, you know, anytime, you know, we can talk and I'm happy to help as much as I can. And it's signed by Jim Butler. Well, she calls Butler's office and says, you know, because she's kind of surprised by this. She calls Butler's office and Butler's office says, oh, we didn't write that letter. And she's like, oh, you didn't write this? He says, no. And immediately Jim Butler calls the Highway Patrol, the Attorney General, and anybody else he could think of. And the Highway Patrol, like, very quickly shows up at Barb Cole's house, gets the letter, took fingerprints from her and I think even DNA samples from her. And they immediately got it to the BCI lab and started, Bureau of Criminal Investigation lab and did testing on the letter. And this has been an ongoing investigation now. This all occurred back in late February.
Wow.
And so it's been an ongoing thing for a while. They've been doing a lot of interviews and things. And I think they think they've got the person who wrote the letter. It was in fact forged. They believe a legislative aide that was not working. I don't believe is working for Rosenberger or Butler, but it comes from a legislative aide, and they're now pursuing criminal charges.
From
now,
another office?
Yes, but it's not clear yet. The motivation is not yet clear. Although, people might say, well, what is this a big deal? Well, it's a big deal because if Jim Butler had actually written the letter to Cliff Rosenberger's opponent in the primary and said, congratulations, I'm here to help, that would have set off a big firestorm because—
Political no-no.
Yeah, that's a big political
Supporting
no-no.
Supporting an outsider against an
against
incumbent of your—
Against an incumbent.
From your caucus.
Right. From your own caucus, that would have been— That would have basically made Jim Butler a pariah in his own caucus.
And somebody who was a candidate for speaker, no less.
Exactly. So that would have ended his speaker race and ended it, would have really made him a black sheep. And so, so he wants this all resolved and he's had to try to, say, look, I didn't write this and clear his name. And it's, Barb Cole says it's probably written to embarrass Jim Butler. So we'll see where this all leads to. But it's just sort of it's just the the way things go sometimes in the world of politics and leadership battles.
Now, you said it's one of the three most powerful people in the state as the Speaker of the House. And I remember back in the days of Vern Reif when the guy had been in office for 20 years. Who in the heck is Cliff Rosenberger?
Well, he's 33 years old. He's
how long's he been in office?
He's been in office now for this is his second term. If he wins, becomes speaker, he could run. He could be speaker for 4 years. He's got some military background. He's worked on some political campaigns. Worked with George Bush's administration for a little while in some different capacities. And so he's got some government political background experience, some military background experience. Very good at building personal relationships,
apparently,
which is one of the reasons he managed to float to the top. He's just slowly but surely has worked his way through members and kind of earned their trust and convinced them that he's going to be a good leader.
Usually, it's someone more experienced, but there isn't much
Not
of that
always.
Going around. Not always.
I can remember when Armin Butish became speaker, when the Democrats took over briefly.
His first term, wasn't it? Or second
I think
term.
It was his second term. Yeah. And so it's not always somebody that—
Nowadays, with term limits.
A lot of these folks have not been there that long. And so it's hard to— I mean, you do have the longtime veterans who've gone back and forth between the House and the Senate, or like Speaker Batchelder, who were there for a while, took a term limits break, came back. Mm-hmm. But there are a lot of folks that are in their second, third terms that you don't really hear that much about.
And someone like Ron Amstutz, he was in the House back in the late 80s, and then he moved over to the Senate, right?
Yes.
And then he moved back to the House.
Yes.
Could he go back to the Senate still? Can you keep going on into infinity like that?
Yeah,
think
pretty
so.
Much. But I'm not sure he wants to. But, he's been there for quite a while now. He's been there over 30 years, so I'm not sure that would be. But he could only run. If he were to be the speaker, he would only have been able to do it for 2 years instead of the four that Rosenberger could do. And I've been told that some folks were not did not like the idea that they would have to go through all this again immediately after electing a new speaker. The race for the speaker after him would then start up again, and they didn't want to have to deal with that.
Is it a surprise that this isn't settled? Like you said, I thought the idea from Speaker Batchelder is you wanted to have Rosenberger and Amstutz come together and figure out who had the best support and then sort of settle it there. Why are we still seeing Representative Butler pushing to do it? Mm-hmm. Is it just because the votes aren't there, or what's going on?
Well, I think it's Representative Butler, and I've heard it described to me as he's the non-establishment team. And these guys, and there is a group in the Republican House Caucus that they tend to be more conservative. They've been a bit of a thorn in the side of leadership, which is kind of funny because Speaker Batchelder used to be that thorn in the side of leadership back when he was a member of the Caveman Caucus years and years ago. But yeah, so there is this group that is not interested in just going along to get along, and so they believe that there are certain issues and certain things that the speaker should adhere to, and they don't think necessarily. I don't know exactly what they are, but they don't think Representative Rosenberger is going to do that. They think Representative Butler would fight more for that. So they have a coalition of put together. I don't know that it's enough that they would win, but I know it's not small enough that you can't at least take them seriously. It's not just like a half dozen folks. This is a sizable enough group that they're going to have to watch. And if the coalition that's backing Rosenberger now, you know, starts to crack over the next 5 months, then there could be a little more turmoil in this whole race, and things could start right back up again.
Has the governor suggested, or do we know if there's a favored candidate for the governor to work with?
Rosenberger has long been considered the governor's candidate, and Rosenberger has said that that's not the case. The governor's administration has said that's not the case, but everyone else believes that's the case, and a lot of it's based on who's backing Rosenberger, and some of the governor's closest advisors and friends are backing Rosenberger. So
I know, and you're out there thinking, who cares who's the next Speaker of the House? But as we mentioned earlier, it's one of the three most powerful people in the state of Ohio, strangely. Okay, email from Mary Jo. There has been a lot of talk of 4 years of surplus in the Ohio budget, but in the beginning, didn't we sell a few major assets to accomplish this? Examples, future turnpike revenues, future liquor revenues, and a bit removed from the state budget, but to some extent connected, the OSU parking revenues. I would like some public policy accounting experts to come up with measurements of public assets that can track down what we own and its condition over time.
I don't think we got rid of the turnpike. I think there was that whole bonding issue rather than actually selling off the turnpike. But certainly the...
There was talk of it.
Right, absolutely. And then the whole liquor profits issue with regard to Jobs Ohio. I mean, that was part of what happened.
These weren't moves necessarily to balance the budget. They were more for specific purposes. Like the turnpike deal was, we're going to use the revenues from the turnpike to back tolls, to back bonds that would use to generate a bunch of money to put into highway and bridge construction. And I guess you could make the argument the state didn't have enough money or could have used more from the budget to fund that. But the idea was we needed a big influx of money to deal with, you know, a growing list of transportation needs. And in the case of the liquor bonds, again, that was specifically for Jobs Ohio to create a revenue stream for them to use for economic development. Again, not necessarily to balance a budget. They're all interrelated, obviously, in terms of the state's financial picture, but it wasn't like a one-time deal. We have this budget hole, so we're going to sell a bunch of bonds backed by turnpike revenue to fill it, that kind of thing.
But, of course, we don't know exactly what they're spending the money on when it comes to Jobs Ohio. That's all what's secret.
Right. In the case of the turnpike bonds, we know what that's been spent on. I mean, there was a list of highway and transportation project priorities, and the argument was, you know, it would take years to get, you know, down this list of projects, and we could speed it up by getting an influx of money from leveraging the turnpike, essentially. And you're right, there was some talk of, you know, do we want to sell it outright, again, to raise this bunch of money that we could use to spend on our highways. But they ultimately went with a plan where the state keeps control of the turnpike, but, you know, essentially gives up the tolls to back these bonds.
And I think Jobs Ohio did produce a one-time, $500 million
cash infusion for the state budget.
Because that basically through the sale, that's what they spent. The Jobs Ohio paid for to acquire the liquor profits. So there was that. So we did get $500 million, but that was a one-time thing. And it's, you know, that's long been either put into the rainy day fund or given back as tax breaks or whatever you'd like to say it was spent on.
You can. Well, I want to thank my guest today, Jim Siegel of the Columbus Dispatch. Jim, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Mark Duquette of Bloomberg News. Mark, thanks again.
Thank you.
And Karen Kessler, Bureau Chief for the Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau. Thanks again, Karen.
Glad to be here.
And thanks to everybody for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.